Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
Well, Jake, first of all, spectacular action between Kenny Omega and Vikingo. Just, you know, amazing, amazing athleticism. It lived up to the billing of a dream match. Excalibur said, if you don't know who Vikingo is, you will by the end of tonight. And I'm sure that is a buzz-generating match for AEW fans who might have wondered, why is this match such a big deal? And I think 17, 18 minutes later, they were like, okay, now I get it. And they wrapped angles around the dream match. This was a more densely booked Dynamite than usual, even coexisting at the same time with building towards the building a dream match around the audience that is, you know, very aware of who Vikingo is. So what's your take on the match and how it was presented and kind of the angle afterwards with Callis and Hangman too?
I don't really have any notes on what you said about the match. It absolutely lived up to the billing. You know, I think the remarkable thing about Vikingo is his ability to weave a lot of those crazy spots into natural looking movements in his offense. And so it doesn't just look like a disjointed sort of spot fest. He actually moves very smoothly and manages to make everything look really sharp. And so you got to tip your hat to somebody who is that skilled at his particular style of wrestling. And I think he's probably the best example going right now of somebody who's just next level in terms of Lucha Libre skills. But it's kind of the standard caveat of, you know, they kind of broom the Dream Match International star away to go to an angle to close the show. I think they probably had to follow up on how they opened the show. And, you know, there needed to be some kind of update about the, you know, the Young Bucks and Hangman situation and what was going on with the Blackpool Combat Club all night. But it did seem like a little bit of a shame that there wasn't more of a moment to soak in that main event before they moved on to the next thing. But I thought the angle itself was fine. I mean, it didn't blow me away with its quality or anything, but at least moved the story forward.
That's the thing. It's a welcome occurrence to see the Bucks and Kenny involved in a storyline. I'm not judging whether it's good or yet not, because I think it's too early to tell. But I'm just glad that they're doing more than just having trios title defenses or telling Brandon, you know, yelling at Brandon Cutler off camera in a joke that, you know, is 3 years ago the last time it was explained, and run into the ground a little bit. Now we actually have something we can talk about regarding Kenny Omega and the Bucks. We've got Blackpool Combat Club, clearly defined. I don't care what era. There's no fans or buts. They're heels right now. I mean, with what they're doing, their tactics, attacking Stu Grayson when he was down and injured, presumably attacking the Bucks off camera before the show went on the air, and then going after Kenny Omega after a grueling, 17, 18 minute battle with up and coming world class young wrestler from Mexico. We've got that established, but you have this intrigue, and I'm intrigued, not grading the storyline execution yet, because it's very early. But I'm intrigued with what's going on with Hangman and Kenny. It seems like the Bucks are going to be stuck in the middle, and maybe Hangman ends up teaming with the Bucks. But then if Kenny's a heel, because he sided with Don Callis, where does that put him in terms of, you know, top level matches? It doesn't set him up for MJF unless they turn MJF face. Might set him up for Adam Cole. But at least it's clear Don Callis is a heel because he faked being hit by Hangman Page. And Hangman, clearly a good guy. He went to the hospital with the Bucks, and then he came back with a 2x4 with a nail sticking out of it just in time after commandeering an ambulance. I hope he enjoys his night in jail. Maybe they'll understand. And cleared the ring. He clearly was the good guy here. Omega believed his best friend, Don Callis, when Don Callis faked that Hangman hit him or knocked him down. I'm sure by the time we're talking here, Jake, it's been explained to Kenny, and it's all cleared up, that his friend Callis framed Hangman, and there'll be no further misunderstanding. And then we'll find out from Omega that he has dumped Callis or didn't approve of it, or because there's no way next week he can still be mad at Hangman, right? I mean, this is on tape, so to speak, and people should be informing him, yeah, your buddy Don Callis, you know, deceived you.
Yeah, they've kind of been teasing, you know, Callis breaking off and doing his own thing. I think he's been, you know, spotted, or at least, you know, they've made a point of showing him on social media interacting with Konosuke Takeshita a number of times. And so I'm wondering if they are just preparing to split up Kenny Omega and Don Callis, because the pairing really hasn't made a lot of sense with Kenny Omega, at least portraying himself as largely a babyface on television. And I don't think they want to go right back to the heel run that he had as a singles wrestler previously. I mean, I think they basically extracted all they could from that character. And so I think we're just seeing the beginning of the end of that relationship. But I think it's going to be, you know, a welcome change. We haven't seen Kenny free of Don Callis in AEW in a number of years now. And I think, you know, getting the band back together, so to speak, when it comes to Hangman and Kenny and the Bucks is something the crowd seems very hot for.
I'm all for Callis breaking off from Kenny and, you know, I don't want to say earning his money, but like earning the appreciation and respect of fans for his potential as a heel manager, or doing his job as a heel manager of actually being integrally involved in a storyline that gets heat on him. Because, you know, just sort of, I mean, and there was potential for that when Kenny and Callis were paired up, and kind of that Nick Bockwinkle, Bobby Heenan pairing of, hey, this is going to be the next great manager wrestler world championship relationship on air. And it just, you know, fell way short of expectations. Callis is talented. He can do more than he's shown so far. And maybe breaking away from Kenny is going to be what's needed. You know, like Sean Radican on Twitter said, like me, hopefully Kenny has access to a TV so we can see what Don Callis did there. Kenny doesn't need access to a TV. He just needs people he trusts backstage to tell him. But yes, he can also watch on TV and find out what happened. So the
I think Hangman is a better weapon. So like, I mean, it was a little odd. I guess he had Riho with, I'm assuming it was supposed to be some sort of facsimile of a pipe.
Yeah.
And then of course, you know, Sting has his trademark baseball bat. And then apparently the best they could do for Hangman was a quickly spray painted board with some nails through it, which he managed to find on his way back from the hospital in some sort of remarkable feat of quick thinking. But maybe they got to find some sort of signature weapon for Hangman. I obviously you probably don't want to go with a noose. That's a little too dark for his character. But certainly he can do better than, like, it felt like Simpsons humor, because they used to do jokes with boards with nails through them. But the way that show closing segment worked out, I'm hoping they can move a little bit more quickly through this storyline than they have with previous Elite stories. I don't want to see this, you know, will they, won't they relationship drama play out over the next like 6 weeks or something. It would be far too long.
It'll be far too long if it's next week in a way. If Kenny is resenting Hangman. Now, if they open up Rampage on Saturday night this weekend or Dynamite next week, and let's not do anything on social media in the meantime, or if you do air it on Dynamite, where Kenny goes, Don, what was that all about? Like, Kenny's got to know. Kenny can't play dumb. He can't, unless Kenny's a heel, and then he can play dumb, but then it has to be, you know, the announcers have to point out, come on, Kenny had all week for people to show him the footage. Don Callis is a snake. He's a weasel. Look at what he did. There's no way Kenny doesn't know that. What's he up to? Or Kenny has to go, come on, Don, what was that all about? And then Don can go, well, you know, I thought this and this. He has this sleazebag explanation. And then Kenny, because he's friends, sort of goes, well, I'll forgive you this time, but don't do it again. Something like that. There has to be something redeeming and believable with Kenny in reaction to having the knowledge we have as viewers that he'll have all week to catch up on. So I hope AEW understands they have to do that, and Kenny and Callis know they have to do that. But if at least we'll break up with Kenny and Don, fine. I'm cool with that. Then maybe Hangman and the Bucks are teaming up in against BBC for the Trios title. Kenny splits off from Callis, and then Callis manages to cash door, or who knows, you know, what they can do multiple things. So it seems like that's where it's heading. And there's, you know, a few potholes. I hope they don't, you know, obvious booking trope potholes that they don't step into between now and next week. That'll be kind of insulting and sloppy. But I don't want to criticize them for something they haven't done. But we've seen so many bookers do it over the years. Hopefully AEW doesn't repeat that. And if that's the case, and they have Kenny respond as a babyface or just not care and align with Don, go one way or the other, then that's fine. Then there's some direction to Omega. This was Kenny's first singles match is in well over a year, almost a year and a half. They talked about that, and it was a hell of a match. And, you know, Kenny afterwards, before he was attacked by Blackpool Combat Club, said sometimes he doesn't know if he can do this anymore. And I think he showed he can still do it. And I think people expected more of this Kenny, you know, when AEW was launched, and a lot of reasonable things, or there's a lot of good excuses for it not happening. But he looks like he's in good shape, and he kept up with this, you know, young 25-year-old who's a huge sensation. So I think Kenny can still do it. Hopefully he's not feeling it too bad tomorrow. But that's the type of Kenny Omega that I think is going to get AEW fans excited and hopefully win back some of the fans who have left since CM Punk, the whole CM Punk debacle took place. How do you feel about Kenny right now, Jake, in terms of what he can still deliver both in the ring and what did you see this week in terms of his acting and promo skills, which seems to be something he hasn't really focused or prioritized in AEW so far?
Well, I mean, he's still kind of a ham, you know, like his facial expressions and his mannerisms, it's all very over the top. I'm curious, you know, what we see from him as a babyface, particularly if they are able to get him away from Don Callis. I'd like to see a Kenny Omega that feels like he's really plugged into the audience. I think that's really, because a lot of the heel run, it seemed like it was going, you know, too much for humor. You know, there was a couple of relatively embarrassing, you know, promo segments on various episodes of Dynamite for him where he just went completely off the rails and I think was way outside of what a lot of fan expectations were for that character. And as you said, they just kind of fell short of expectations for what I thought, you know, could have been a very promising pairing. So what I've seen from Kenny since he's been back, unfortunately, very little. You know, he hasn't really been involved in any major angles. They haven't really had him doing much in the way of promos. He only got a few words in before he was attacked tonight. And, you know, in the backstage segment earlier on in the show with Callis, he kind of played a secondary role because it was clear that, you know, Callis is pursuing his own, his own endeavors at that point. And so it's hard to really get a read on what to expect from Kenny, but I'm hoping that there's more of a focus on building a character for him because I think long-term that's far more serviceable than attempting to have him just try to continue to have dream matches on television and pay-per-view until the end of his current contract and maybe beyond if he sticks around. So the future for Kenny is going to have to be, you know, can I build a character and can it stand on its own and, you know, can I have some separate identity from the Elite that is purely Kenny Omega? Because we just really haven't seen that in AEW.
Yes. Yep. Great. Jake, I'm noticing overmodulation or scratchiness in your mic that I haven't picked up on before. So I don't know if you want to check your connection or your settings. Maybe we'll have to live with it.
I might have the volume too loud on the microphone. I'll try to adjust that down a little bit.
Okay. Yep. I just wanted to cover that in case it's fixable. It's tolerable, but not great. All right. So let's go ahead and pause and introduce ourselves formally here and invite people to participate in the show. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, March 22nd, 2023. And I'm Wade Keller, the host of the show, the editor, publisher, and founder of the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter and the website pwtorch.com. On that website, by the way, you can find my real-time reports on Dynamite, Raw, and SmackDown every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday night. So if you're not checking up pwtorch.com for any other reason, there's a reason. You can not only get caught up on what happens in case you don't see the show or the whole show, but you can also get my analysis of most of the segments and matches as the show airs or afterwards. That's pwtorch.com. Got tons of great news stories and real wide range of diverse voices writing different columns focused in different areas. So hopefully you are checking out our website in addition to our podcast. And the other voice you hear on today's show is Jake Barnett from ProWrestling.net. Jake, welcome back to the co-host chair.
Thanks, Wade. Always happy to be here. Hopefully I sound a little bit better now.
Yep, I'll let you know when you get a bigger sample size. Tough to tell so far. The phone number, if you want to join the program, is 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. When you call, push 1 on your keypad. That'll flag you on the switchboard, and that lets us know you want to be on the show. Nobody yet has pushed 1, so if you are interested in talking to us, you can push 1 and get on pretty quick. Again, that's 347-215-8558. You can also email the show at wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. All right, Jake, another big happening on the show today that I like quite a bit, the follow-up to last week's four-pillar segment. And it was just in the form of a video package that they put together highlighting what happened last week. We didn't have fresh material with MJF this week, and we had Darby in a match, but no Jungle Boy, no Sammy Guevara. But the video package, I think, was a real suitable follow-up to what they did last week, in part because it addressed one of the criticisms of the segment last week, which is, okay, MJF the champion. There's no obvious number one contender. So three fellow pillars walk out and declare they want a match, but a company that was founded on wins and losses counting, records counting, rankings counting, want a title shot. Well, none of them really deserve it based on their recent track record in the ring. Well, they all kind of addressed that in that video. MJF said, you guys need to prove you deserve a title shot. And then the other three, or at least two out of three, explicitly said, you know, look at my record. I've been winning. I want to win more. I want to earn a title shot. To me, that's great. Like, acknowledge that there's a ways to go before those three who just decided to interrupt an MJF promo are deserving of a title shot. I thought it was a good recap of the segment, but mostly a good follow-up with fresh sound bites. What did you think?
Yeah, I was of the opinion that their segment last week just came across as a bit uneven. You know, there were some high points, there were some low points, but I do think that AEW will benefit from having a younger group of challengers for the AEW World Championship. And I thought the follow-up tonight made sense. You know, I was wondering if they were angling towards a pay-per-view match with this, or if they were going to try to pay it off on Dynamite, you know, sooner than later. But it looks like they are, you know, looking at something a bit more long-term, where all three of these guys are going to have to earn their spot in what I assume will end up being some kind of fatal four-way match, and then we'll end up with a pay-per-view encounter out of the deal. And so, I think this is a good start. We'll just have to see, you know, how they're able to pull it off over the next, you know, several months as they head into Double or Nothing.
If that turns out eventually to be MJF in a singles feud against one of them, does that be Jack Perry, Jungle Boy? Could it be Darby in a full-fledged feud? They already, you know, had a pay-per-view match. Could it be Sammy Guevara as a heel? Or I don't think they're going to turn a babyface. Like, or is this really, no, it's got to be like a four-way type situation, four pillars, and then MJF just moves on to, you know, Adam Cole or something like that? Or is there a middle ground where, yeah, you can do a pay-per-view, maybe a pay-per-view fatal four-way type style match, but then maybe a singles blow-off match on TV against Jungle Boy? Like, just what's your assessment of those three as challengers for him once you get past sort of the macro four-pillar connection that they have?
I think Jack Perry and Darby would both make suitable opponents for a pay-per-view if they spent, you know, the next 6 to 8 weeks really building them up, giving them important victories, you know, allowing them to develop more of a connection to the audience, both, you know, through promos and through, you know, key matches on television. I think it's probably more likely that we're going to get the fatal four-way. And I think Sammy Guevara becomes the obvious, like, scapegoat there. He can take a loss, and the babyfaces don't necessarily lose anything in defeat, and then perhaps you can go back to one or both of them as television opponents after the pay-per-view, you know, before you officially move on to Adam Cole. But I mean, it's not impossible to think that one or both of Perry and Allen could be singles competitors for the AEW championship, but they're, I think the company is invested in the idea of these guys being four pillars, and it just may be too attractive for Tony Khan to not feature them all in a match at one point or another. And then this seems like as good a time as any.
Yeah, yeah. So one person who, you know, is going to challenge MJF at some point is Adam Cole, and he made his return tonight with a hyped and signature or centerpiece promo segment from him. And I thought he showed who the Adam Cole is that people wanted to see when he was signed. And I wrote this in my report at pwtorch.com this week. I might have even said it in recent weeks in another context. Adam Cole still has a chance to be the most valuable contributor in AEW overall among the three major signings. And he's got some catching up to do with Bryan Danielson for sure. And CM Punk certainly made an impact business-wise on, you know, more than a couple occasions, but has been out injured, and then, you know, the controversy and you know, who knows if he returns. But Cole has a chance because of his age, hopefully his health, even with everything he's been through, but that, you know, is yet to be played out and seen. But the Adam Cole we saw tonight is an Adam Cole that doesn't come with the political locker room personality quirk baggage that's follows CM Punk everywhere. He brings with him everywhere. And he also is still hungry to be a centerpiece act in a way that I don't think Bryan Danielson is, you know, who's got a lot more mileage on his tires. So tonight I thought was, if you're Tony Khan looking at, can I build around this guy as the lead babyface? I think tonight the answer was yes, in part because they had a great crowd in Independence, Missouri, who were super into Adam Cole. He fed off of that. He just, you know, he carries himself as an alpha. He is one of the smallest centerpiece main event acts on a national scale you'll ever see. And it just doesn't matter in the AEW context, especially if he's a babyface. So I thought this was a really good sign. And I am hoping he is healthy and can stay healthy. But this Adam Cole can be the credible singles rival that I don't think Jack Perry's ready to be. And I think Darby's too much of kind of a niche character to be in terms of opposing MJF as sort of that generational battle, the generational rivalry that will define, you know, 2023. And if they both stick around AEW, even longer. Am I overhyping Adam Cole, do you think, Jake?
Well, I guess it really does boil down to his health, as you already mentioned. You know, if the post-concussion syndrome returns and it becomes more of a problem for him as time goes on, then certainly, you know, I don't know if he's if that's a long-term, you know, decade-long prospect for AEW. I think if his health is good and he stays healthy, then yes, absolutely. He's somebody that they can build around. And I think he, you know, particularly, you know, his promos as a babyface exude a level of polish that is uncommon in AEW. And I think he showed that tonight. Although there are times when he gets a bit like too cute to the point where it becomes like kind of sing-songy and he's cramming in catchphrases and words and things that come across a bit unnaturally at times. But I think that's such an easy thing to dial back and fix that I don't even really worry about it that much. But I think they had two guys in the ring that they should be looking at as potential, you know, future megastars for AEW. I think Daniel Garcia has made incredible progress in a short period of time when it comes to being a personality and carrying a promo segment and feeling like he belongs out there with somebody like Adam Cole. And so I think both of them showed a lot of promise. And I think if Cole can, you know, can take some of that sort of sugar coating off of some of his verb choices and things like that, I think he'll be perfect. You know, he's right in a zone where people love him. His delivery is good. He knows how to feed off of an audience's energy. He knows how to use his energy to pump up an audience. He's a polished star. Like there's not much you need to do with somebody like Adam Cole, and he delivers in the ring almost every time he's out there. So I think you know, if there's somebody that you were going to pick to, you know, dethrone MJF down the road, you know, once they get through the Four Pillars match at Double or Nothing, I think Cole would be on your shortlist.
Yeah. Yep. I agree. All right. Let's go to JB from Detroit. He's got an email saying, one, asking the important question first, is staring at the Double or Nothing banner the new staring at the WrestleMania sign? Is that a bad thing to copy if they do it to the degree that WWE does or anything close to it? Is it good branding and you have to deal with some of the pushback?
I mean, I think, you know, mimicry is fine. It's just one of those things that happens when something works and people understand the symbolism of it and what it means, then, you know, there's really no reason not to do it. It's just don't go quite as ham-fisted with it as WWE does, where you have everybody on the show at some point throughout a pay-per-view build staring at a sign. But, I mean, in the right moments, I think it makes perfect sense, although, you know, I think Darby might have stared at it just a bit too long. I think he was – but it was okay for what it was. I think it was good. I just like the fact that they are planting those seeds. You know, it's a company that I've criticized regularly for – you know, for not being narratively driven enough and having, you know, characters identify goals and make those goals plain for everybody to see is a good thing.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Up next, he says, I did like how they incorporated the Kenny Omega versus Vikingo story throughout the show. It did make the main event seem bigger and did its best at explaining the match's significance. Although I still think the better option would have been to schedule the match a few weeks out, so we'd have a few weeks to actually become familiarized with Vikingo. Yes, let's talk about that for a second, because it is, I think, a valid criticism, and I have been among them making it, that telling people a match is a dream match, and we'll find out tomorrow how, you know, the ramifications of the approach that they took, but that is not enough for most people. AWO's credibility with their fan base, but people, humans are humans. They want to be emotionally invested in something if they're going to go out of their way to watch it. And obviously AWO is facing declined viewership, and especially in that 35 to 49-year-old slice of the demographic, they've lost a significant chunk of viewers compared to a year ago when CM Punk was around. And so is throwing that out there as a main event, and just having Excalibur tout him as a dream opponent, a dream match, was it enough? And even if it's even if it reaches if it hits a level of being enough without criticism, is there still a better way to get more out of it, even if it ultimately is just a one-off? Or if it is just a one-off for now, is it actually good not to devote more TV time to it? Because, you know, just let the match speak for itself. It's Kenny Omega. We wrapped an angle around it. But we don't want to spend too much TV time on a guy who isn't going to be our new hot star week in and week out. And I think that's, besides AW maybe having a bad habit of thinking everybody is on Twitter and knows everything that and is watching everything outside of AEW, which Mike McMahon and Andrew Sochek talked about on their PW Torch Daily Cast yesterday as an issue for them. It also just might be a strategy, like a deliberate strategy. They deserve more credit, which is we don't want to make people too excited about this guy because he's not going to be here full time.
Yeah, I think those are fair criticisms. You know, there's something to be said for really billboarding somebody and making them feel special. I even if you weren't going to have availability for Vikingo of having him come in and work you know, a number of matches before he gets ready for Omega. They have a partnership with AAA. They could have put together some videos to really get people excited about him. And I think that could have benefited, you know, portions of the audience who aren't glued to social media and are hyper aware of everything that's going on in pro wrestling. I mean, you look at, you know, like the social media penetration for somebody like Vikingo. He has far fewer followers than you do, Wade, you know, in terms of how many people are actively looking at him on social media on a regular basis. So I think any way that
you're saying I should have headlined against Kenny Omega tonight.
I think there might have been a few more people who knew who you were if you were booked to fight Kenny Omega in the main event. But
wow.
I there's certainly you know, an argument to be made that, well, we only had him for this one day. His availability is very limited. He's not going to be working with us long term. We don't want to expend 10 or 15 minutes of television over the course of 2 or 3 weeks setting this up, because the payoff is just going to be this one match and then it's over with. But I think if there's any chance, like, you know, hey, we think we can get this guy semi-regularly, or, you know, he's going to have a, you know, he might be contractually available at some point in the future, then billboarding him as a major deal and treating him as an international star prior to the night that he's going to appear on the show and wrestle your most heralded singles act is probably a good idea.
Yeah. Yep. All right. So back to JB. Number three, I'm predicting Don Callis actually called for the Bucks to get taken out. Where this leads, I'm not sure. Perhaps Callis will take on managing the BBC or the Blackboard. No, BCC. BBC is something else. That's me, not JB. I had to check myself there. In what was William Regal's role against the Elite in the Blood and Guts match after Forbidden Door? So, yeah, what do you think about the idea of well, does it make sense that Callis would be behind the Blackpool Combat Club attacking everybody? Well, I mean, that I guess he would have already not had Kenny's best interest in mind and was faking it tonight. So, play that out a little bit. Does that intrigue you, and is tonight consistent with that? I won't say theory, but just positing a possibility.
I mean, I guess I can't say it's impossible that he could have tipped off, you know, the Blackpool Combat Club as to when and where the Bucks were going to show up at the arena or something. But I don't know why they would like even entertain the idea of him being their manager. You know, like the culture of that group is not, we have this huckster stand out in front of us and deliver promos. You know, it's just a very different vibe
exactly.
that the Blackpool Combat Club gives off. And so I really don't see that being the direction that they go in, but would temporary allies, because they have common interests, make sense? Yeah, I guess you could make that work, but it would have to be in service of, you know, Callis trying to serve his own interests in some other way. I don't think it would be those two in combination for any length of time.
So JB said this would be a great way to turn Kenny Omega face. Is he not a face? Is he a heel? I don't even know. While also taking him away from the trios division so he can focus on another high-level singles run. Well, I think most people would like him to have a high-level singles run. I think Kenny would like to feel physically able to do that, and it does seem like he's in a better spot, at least going into tonight, than he was before. Like I said, how he feels tomorrow might say a lot about where the confidence he has in still being able to be the best belt machine. JB adds on a side note, I liked how they weave the Bucks getting attacked story throughout the show and had a greater feeling of connectivity. Talk about that, Jake. What did you think of – did we ever see Nick? Do we even know if Nick was there?
Well, they said he was loaded into an ambulance off screen, and then they never showed him being loaded into the ambulance like they did Matt. So it's entirely possible that he just wasn't there at all.
And it's not a big deal. I was like, did I miss it, or is it possible that Nick didn't make the flight? I hope Nick didn't. Well, I guess he's in EVP and he should have other duties, right? But hope he didn't fly out just to be in an ambulance with the door closed, and they never showed he was actually there. I opening the show with, you know, Paul Levesque was doing this early on in his booking run, like opening Raw with like, oh, there's craziness going on even before the show goes on the air. That was kind of an early thing he was doing. And I like that. I don't think you should overdo it, but when it happens and it should be a major angle and it should be followed up on. And it was. We also got the, you know, ambulance, having vehicles part of a wrestling angle is, you know, whether it's milk trucks, beer trucks, limousines, monster trucks, ambulances, it's part of, you know, you expect to see that now and then on primetime cable wrestling shows. So AW had a couple ambulances driving off. My 7-month-old puppy finally got worn out today, and this will tie in here. It took all day to wear him out. Finally, about 5 minutes before the end of Dynamite, he's like, I'm ready to fall asleep, which is perfect timing because I got to do this podcast. And then the ambulance came back, and the sirens are blaring, and he pops up from his nap and starts barking at the sirens. So thanks, Hangman. You he fell back asleep. So all's well that ends well. But for a minute there, I was panicked. But yeah, Hangman came back, and we got, you know, ambulances. I mean, I like some out of ring story, footage and storylines, and so that aspect I liked. And obviously, you know, it gives an explanation for why the Bucks weren't there to make a run in and make the save on Kenny, and kind of keeps them out of the Don Callis mystery, and keeps them actually away from even storyline wise being able to instantly explain to Omega what Callis did. Although presumably Matt was well off enough to watch from the hospital or get texts of what happened and inform Kenny of it. But yeah, what did you think is there anything you would critique or have done differently with that angle in particular?
No, I actually thought it worked pretty well. AEW needs more show-spanning stories. They need more stars featured in multiple segments. You know, there's a lot of segments on some of these episodes that feel somewhat random, and oftentimes matches come in very cold because there's been very little explanation, whether, you know, on previous week's episodes of Dynamite or Rampage or something that's been explained by the announce team. And so the more segments you can keep people glued to the show because they believe that they're going to get follow up on what major stars have been doing or pay off to, you know, a show spanning angle, that's good. That's good things. And so I hope this kind of stuff continues. Was this angle like perfect? Did they nail it? Well, I mean, maybe not. There's probably things that you could nitpick about it. You know, the acting wasn't perfect, and you know, it was the explanation of what was going on as the show kind of flew into action was a bit chaotic. But I think the general principle of introducing stories at the top of the show and then carrying them all the way through to the main event is a good idea going forward.
Yeah. JB also says, if Callis does break away from Kenny in the Bucks, how do you see him best being used? So you got into that a little bit, but elaborate, Jake. What are the options for Don Callis if he isn't still linked with Kenny? And that certainly seems like a distinct possibility at this point. What options are there for him that make sense? Is he even worth spending a bunch of energy on trying to figure out how to utilize him?
Well, I guess there's plenty of young heels on the show that could, you know, take advantage of having a very clever heel manager, you know, that can assist them in talking segments and you know, run interference for them backstage and, you know, get involved in matches to a degree. I mean, there's, you know, those kinds of partnerships are classic, and you know, they have a long history of working. And so I guess it depends on who they identify as being a young up-and-coming heel that needs some help, you know, and I don't know who Tony Khan would necessarily fit into that category, but they have shown, you know, a number, I'm sure they were, you know, planting seeds through social media of Callis with Takeshita and trying to pull him under his wing. And so whether or not that ends up extending on to television eventually, I don't know. It's kind of hard to imagine Takeshita being embraced as a heel, but stranger things have happened.
JB also says, can we nip this QTV thing in the bud after week two? I think most would agree. It's already 2 weeks past due. As always, love the show and go VIP. I didn't mind QTV last week. Didn't love it, but this week it didn't do really anything for me. And I think if it's a weekly feature, I think there'll be some pretty strong pushback. There's a smug self-satisfaction in QT's body language and demeanor that sort of defines him. And that works if it's sort of just there when he's coming to the ring or standing in the ring for a match, or cutting a traditional wrestling promo. This sort of implicit promise that we're going to get a minute or two of him being him in a segment that is at best forwarding lower to mid-card storylines, and at worst just this sort of self-indulgent overestimation of the entertainment value of imitating whatever they're trying to imitate with, you know, TMZ TV or whatever they're doing with characters who are either not named or not well-defined or not well-known or well-established. I'm kind of with JB. Unless they can do better, pull the plug, especially if it's going to be, OMG, they made a reference to something on Twitter that nobody thought they would ever bring up. That's just such there's not a big enough eye roll emoji to cover how what a dumb use of TV time I think that would be at this point. So Jake, there's my thoughts. How about yours?
Yeah, I guess there was a very inside reference to I think it was The Observer in there, and then they mentioned that apparently Aaron Solo had so completely hacked into Wardlow's life that he was going to lose his house and his car. That was really the only developments in there that were even remotely entertaining. Everything else just feels like a very low-rent ripoff of the TMZ television show, and I think QT is trying to channel some facsimile of Harvey Levin, the founder of TMZ and the host of the television show, and he's just like not charming enough to make it work, you know. It's a huge swing and a miss for me. It's not even in that so bad it's good category.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
It's just bad, you know. There's just not a whole lot that's redeemable about it, and I don't really see that kind of format, particularly when these segments are 30 seconds or less, like really, you know, getting anybody over. And I'm glad they removed Powerhouse Hobbs for week two, because he looked like he would have rather been like ejected out of an airlock into space the previous week than sit on that set for any longer than he was there. And I don't blame him, because that just was not a conduit for him to improve his status in the company.
Yes. Yeah, I hope that's a sign of things not to come as far as that goes. All right, up next, Zach in Texas says, what a show. Between the slugfest with Grayson and Mox and the astounding match between Kenny and Vikingo, I'm pretty sure Kenny's next match has to be made of adamantium. What? Has to be made of adamantium? What is that?
I believe that's a fictional material used in the X-Men comics. It's the metal that Wolverine's bones are made out of.
Ah, okay. Yeah. The more you know. He said, nobody can touch the in-ring quality of AEW. Now it's all about this multi-layered story with the Elite, Dark Order, BCC, Hangman Page, and Don Callis. The moment Kenny Omega lays out that snake in the full Elite reunite, the roof is going to come off the building. I do wonder where Takeshita fits in all of this, but between this and the Outcast versus the OGs, AEW is really cooking right now. So is it possible? I mean, of course it's possible. He's laying out the idea that Hangman and Kenny see what Callis did, and that's the turning point for them to dump Callis, because he's stirring trouble, doesn't have their best interest in mind. And they unite with the Bucks, and they're a foursome, and they're either going after singles titles or teaming together for tag team or trios matches while the other is going after a singles title. And then he's not sure where that leaves Callis, but maybe Takeshita. Obviously, they haven't been doing the Takeshita Callis stuff for no reason. Where that's leading, hopefully they'll just drop it, but, you know, because they changed their mind. But do you like the idea of Takeshita being this kind of naive, manipulated understudy of Callis? Is that a good use of him, or would that be the worst heel turn since AEW turned Danny Garcia after he rejected Jericho Appreciation Society, believably, and seemed to have the fans really behind him and wind at his back as a babyface? Would that be a bad move, or because of the language barrier, would that actually be a good move?
Well, I guess I wouldn't hate the idea of Callis being, you know, such a smooth talker that he convinces, you know, a guy like Takeshita to join him, you know, temporarily, even if he's, you know, tentative or pensive about it. But they've done nothing with Takeshita but have him lose on television in all manner of matches, both high and lower profile. And so I think the best way to go about putting those two together is just have Takeshita be completely ignorant of Callis's interference in his matches and just have him go on a winning streak and have Takeshita like link the two together. Like, hey, I'm, you know, since this guy joined up with me, I've been doing nothing but win. And so he just overlooks the fact that it's underhanded tactics that are getting him there. And then eventually you might be able to just have him do a heel turn where it's like, well, I'm not going to go back to losing, so I guess this is just who I am now. And that's fine. You know, at least give the guy a trajectory and a story. And that gets Callis away from the Elite, and that lets them tell more interesting stories, because it's been a very strange partnership having Callis around while all of them are at least supposedly baby faces, and put Hangman and the Elite back together again, because I think that's something the crowds have desperately wanted for a long time now. So if they can make that work, I think it would be a benefit for everybody involved.
Yep. Grayson Amox, what'd you think of that? We haven't talked about that yet.
I mean, great match. I don't think it was anywhere close to the main event in terms of intensity or athleticism, but I continue to be impressed with the fact that Moxley just comes to work every week and puts in solid matches. I don't know if there's a whole lot to really comment about it. He just continues to have workman-like quality matches that take up 10 minutes of TV time, and he wins far more than he loses, and he continues to look strong. I want to see more narrative development around the Blackpool Combat Club. I think, you know, they've done a lot of talking with physicality over the past few weeks, but they haven't really had any moments to clarify what their intent is. And obviously they're heading down the road of a heel turn, and they're they have some very popular characters in that faction who can talk, and yet they just don't get the minutes to do that. So that's where I think they might be falling short with the Blackpool Combat Club. But Grayson and Moxley worked well together. I have no complaints, and they managed to avoid any serious mistakes or injuries. It was just a smooth, professional looking match.
Do you think fans are going to boo Claudio Moxley and Yuta? Genuinely, they're going to play along, or it's not going to work and it's going to undercut the baby faces that they're against?
No, I think if you put the Elite and Omega with Hangman, and you get that band back together, so to speak, and Moxley and his crew are nasty and savage enough to attack them, and they put the Bucks out tonight. If they don't have to do that, obviously, every week to that scale. But if they're vicious enough, I think they will get booed. And I think Moxley can put in the mic work that will make that stick. I don't think it would take him long to turn a crowd against him.
Yeah. Interesting approach, though. Decision on their part to do that. What was I going to say about Zach's email? Oh, just the prominence of Dark Order lately on AEW television. Has it been too much? Or is this actually – it's kind of the argument I've been making with QT Marshall, which is if you believe in him, then feature him every week and develop his character fully. Don't have him show up and then disappear for weeks or months and then show up again and expect people to care. You got him, use him, and if you believe in him, stick with it. And sort of a Dark Order, do you apply that same standard? Like, hey, it's kind of whittled down to a more of a core group right now, and they're having better than expected matches and getting decent crowd responses, and they're a good second tier kind of utility group to be out there. Where are you right now on this? And you hate to say, well, this is at a time when Dynamite's ratings aren't strong and you're featuring Evil Uno in competitive matches, and blame Evil Uno, because I think that would be unfair, but it does also correlate. Again, I know Dark Order have been around from the beginning, but I don't think anyone's been super excited about them being a centerpiece featured faction this deep into AEW's run, especially with not a lot of differentiation between the characters or evolution of any of them where fans feel any more bonded to them other than their buddies of Hangman who can sometimes have good, exciting sort of mid-card matches with other top people or mid-card people.
Well, I think Uno and Grayson are a very good tag team, and I think they're both very strong workers, and I think they could succeed in the tag division right now, which at least in my opinion has been severely downgraded since the trios division was formed and a lot of talent was diverted into that that arena to make that thing work and get off the ground. And so I don't know if you necessarily need to disband the Dark Order. I don't know if that would be the answer, but I do think you need to actually spend the time to define what they are philosophically, you know, 3 years into AEW, they've been through, you know, a harrowing situation with Brody Lee, and they've kind of told and completed their story with Hangman Page. So what are they now? You know, what is this group? What do they stand for? What do they mean to each other? What is their mission? Like, tell us those things and then justify their existence. I don't know if you can continue to send them out there week after week, and you know, even though they're having quality competitive matches, and expect crowds to be invested in them long term, because they don't win all that often. They're kind of the, you know, the undercard mascots of the promotion in a lot of ways, and you know, they're probably, you know, office favorites, so to speak, because they put in a lot of quality work during the you know, during the COVID period in AEW, and I think there's a lot of loyalty built based off of that. But there's certainly not enough justification to feature them in primetime slots and main events when you have so much talent that doesn't get featured on weekly television.
All right. Up next, David from North Carolina comments on QT. He's listening to our conversation here, and he said, I like QT Marshall. I actually enjoy hating QT Marshall, and I think he could be a great heel manager for the right client, not Powerhouse Hobbs, which is why I'm so disappointed by this angle. This is not the way to use him. I think most hate QT, but I see someone with great potential as a manager for a smarmy heel who's great in the ring, but who can't talk and who flaunts how good he is in the ring. This TMZ thing is such a huge miss for him, though. Just kind of concurring with us as far as QT goes. And I think QT, as an agitating, unlikable, smarmy manager of a mid-carder who eventually breaks away from him and then moves up the card, is sort of how I would see him. And I guess that's sort of where Stokely Hathaway is at this point in his role. So, I mean, and heck, smart Mark Sterling to a degree too, although now he's associating with Jade Cargill. But, you know, they have a good number of managers in that role, and I don't know. I don't even like spending this much time on QT on a show, but David, I think is on in terms of what's not working and how this is a pretty big swing and a miss after 2 weeks. So I'm curious if they see this as if it is universally panned, if they are stubborn and lean harder into it and try to make it more entertaining, or if they think that's the type of feedback we want. We want people hating on us, and you know, any kind of heat is good heat. So I guess we'll see.
I hope they don't draw that kind of conclusion from it. You know, there's any heat is good heat, I think is misguided, because there are going to be people who turn the station and disappear for 15, 20 minutes and come back for a main event. You know, if they aren't, you know, feeling the vibe of what's on the show that night. And I don't really have any disagreement with what he said. I think, you know, QT could be an asset if he was used in the right context. I just don't think the TMZ ripoff is the right format for him. And I'm not sure that Hobbs is the right guy for him to be managing either. I think Hobbs can stand on his own without help.
Yeah. Yep. Speaking of Stokely, what'd you think of how they played out the match with Hook? I'll preface by saying, on the bright side, they recapped the angle a little bit, which I think was needed, because this angle got kind of cold, and that's only because it was lukewarm at its hottest. It needed to be reheated a little bit, and I thought, you know, the Stokely handing a doctor's note to Justin Roberts and it turning out to be a receipt for some wings joint, I'm not sure that was the joke was worth the time spent on it. But the idea that Hathaway was, you know, desperate to get out of the match, and when certain things didn't work, he just ran into the crowd, and then, you know, he got a little advantage with some help, but ultimately lost. My conclusion was it was a relatively harmless, satisfying chapter in the Hook Hathaway faction feud. How about you?
Yeah, I thought it was how they needed to pay it off. You know, Hook looked like a badass. Stokely got to have, you know, some comedy spots where, you know, his brand of humor was spotlighted. You know, the Wingstop receipt, I don't even think that was the funniest part of that joke. I thought the attempt at preemptively retiring before the match was funnier. And then, of course, the physical comedy of of Stokely attempting to attack Hook a couple of times and just bouncing off of him like he was a racquetball or something. It was fine. It was, you know, exactly how you would expect a run-in between those two characters to go. And, you know, I'm sure it got a few laughs from people on social media who enjoyed both characters. So it only took up, what, like maybe 3 or 4 minutes of TV time? It certainly wasn't something that overstayed its welcome or took away from anything else on the show. It's something that they've been, you know, they spent enough time building towards that I think they had to pay it off this way.
What is the totality of what Juice Robinson has done to Ricky Starks? And I ask that because Ricky was so like distressed over Juice talking about him incessantly. And if you're like just a Dynamite viewer, but even Dynamite and Rampage, and you add it all up, I'm not quite sure there's enough there to justify Starks's demeanor and the way Renee even phrased the question. It seems like there should have been more agitating by Juice before we got to the stage where Ricky was acting as distressed as he was over it. Are you with me on that, or do you think I'm just forgetting or not giving enough credit to what Juice has done to agitate Ricky to date?
I don't think they've done nearly enough to justify Starks being this upset about it, particularly because he's, you know, his character up until this point has been the guy who outsmarts the heels, who's cool as a cucumber. And he just, you know, there's a video package and a couple of, there was one segment of physicality and then a couple of verbal segments on Rampage. And then, you know, he's been completely gotten to, you know, and I'm not sure it's a direction for Starks that I've enjoyed. I think this has been a huge step down for him going from Jericho to Juice, who kind of came into this program cold and if anything is borrowing some credibility from Starks at this point. So it seems a bit upside down in the way that it's been approached thus far. I would have thought that that it would have been Ricky who was the one who was trying to verbally manipulate Juice out into the open so he could finally get his revenge on him.
Yeah. How about the Tony Storm Sky Blue match and the continuation of I think it was Zach who mentioned this in his email. That was actually what I was thinking of, I believe, that I wanted to follow up on with that. Are they doing a good job keeping this moving? Outcasts and the Originals. Did this work this week?
Yeah, I mean, it was okay. It just feels like they're kind of treading water a little bit, maybe. I think they had that one, or maybe it was two promo segments in total where they kind of outlaid their philosophy for, you know, what this group is and why they decided to come together and those types of things. And I think, you know, they were largely fairly logically delivered and the performances were mostly good. And so I'm on board with the direction for the group. I just think they have to do more to establish the characters of the Originals, you know, Sky Blue, Willow Nightingale, Riho, I guess has her following. But I think the issue here is that the baby faces don't feel like they're hot and the heels are kind of waiting for them to get there before they can really move forward with the program. And unfortunately, because of the limited segments that the women typically get on Dynamite, they don't really get a chance to have a lot of talking segments. And if they do, then they typically don't get a match. And so it's typical to see them struggle when they're just not generally the focus of these shows.
Well, what do you think of the promo last week, especially Saraya and Ruby and some of what I thought was kind of tawdry, trashy content, verbiage is Jim Ross would say smoother than I just did, maybe back in the day when he did Dynamite. It just felt like they were kind of leaning on just some of the stuff that permeated Impact Wrestling back in the day while the women wrestlers called each other skanks. And then there was this, you know, swearing and Tony Khan came down on it and said that, you know, that wasn't cleared and we didn't hear from them this week. So maybe that was, that would happen anyway, maybe not. But what was your take on last week's segment and overall how you think that group is doing in terms of establishing chemistry and an identity?
Well, I think the mistake was going after the audience. Because we've seen, MJF in particular say some absolutely outrageous things in regards to himself and his own actions, and in calling out his opponents and bringing up their families, that was every bit as shocking as what the Outcast did in their promo. I just think they picked the wrong target and they paid a price for it. I don't know if the stuff about the fines is accurate or if that's just something that was that was played for social media attention. But I do think that in general, going directly after the audience in such an explicit way is probably a mistake. If you're going to say something shocking, if you're going to be explicit in the service of a fictional story, then talk about the people that you're in the story with, and not the casual observers.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Let's go to David, North Carolina, who is calling now. David, welcome to the show.
Hi guys, how you doing?
Great, good to hear from you.
Can you hear me? You can hear me. I want to say I agree with your comments on QT Marshall. I feel like that's actually very, very accurate. I feel like he's a very talented guy. He puts the milk into milk toast, and they should really highlight that in the mid card. Pretty much everything that you said on that, both of you. So I agree with that. But I wanted to ask about a couple of other things. First, you mentioned that you guys were talking about a Blackpool Combat Club earlier, and I may have missed it, or maybe I missed it on the show. But, did they turn heel? And obviously, I guess they're heel. But did they give a reason why? Just because I'm not paying attention and missed it? Blackpool Combat Club is heel now?
Yeah. I mean, they sort of just started showing an edge. Claudio was yelling at Wheeler to be more intense. Moxley was upset with Hangman, who was upset with him, and they went to war. But I think it's a good point David's making. There's not – I don't think, Jake, and correct me if I'm wrong or remind us, I would have liked the dots being connected a little bit by the announcers to act more disgusted or outraged with their actions, and maybe – one approach they could take is claiming, or not claiming, but concluding that Moxley's upset because of how things went with Hangman, and now he's taking it out on others. What do you think?
Yeah, I think we need the promo. We need Moxley, if Claudio and Wheeler want to speak up for themselves, that's fine too. But Danielson is essentially out for the time being, and obviously William Regal has gone back to WWE in a non-television role, and so there really hasn't been an effort to redefine what the Blackpool Combat Club is since those two things occurred. And so I think we just need to hear directly from the source, what their motivations are, what their plans are. This isn't necessarily a complete reinvention of the Blackpool Combat Club. They started, from the perspective of, we only admit members that bleed with us, and we're out for blood, and we take these fights seriously, and we enjoy combat. But they have this new edge to them, and it has gone largely unexplained. And unfortunately, the way that AEW's announced team is structured, you're just as likely to hear Tony Schiavone praising their tactics as you are to hear anybody outraged, about their appalling behavior. And so I think there has been a disconnect between the presentation and the act, because they have taken on, a new persona. They have assaulted people backstage. They've done things that are seemingly out of character for who they were just a few months ago. They haven't had a chance to talk about it yet, but you also don't have anybody in the broadcast team asking those questions, which I think is a mistake.
It seems like this week's happenings, David, is perfect setup for finally getting some answers and Alex Marvez or Renee or Tony Schiavone, cornering them and confronting them and demanding some answers for what they're doing. So maybe we'll get that. It's more been showing than telling to this point, but starting next week, they'll actually start telling and explaining why they have taken this turn.
Okay. I mean, I guess you're right. We should give them a couple of weeks to do it. I think I've mentioned when I've called them before that I have a friend who is brand new to watching wrestling. Not my boyfriend, but he's brand new to watching wrestling. And he's gotten really into the product. And when he was watching the Blackpool Combat Club's match and they're beating up, you know, he asked the question. And he said, I guess it's a mystery. And I said, no, it's not a mystery, because in writing, a mystery only really works if they want you to be mystified. And I don't think they're trying to drag this into a big mystery. It seems like they're just trying to go like, okay, they're bad now. And they're just going to go like, great.
Yeah.
And some of the stuff they've done is just so contrary to the constitution of the characters. They Moxley picked up a chair and just like threw it during his match at his opponent. Where, you know, they've always been about being super tough, but not about cheating. That's why it was such a big deal that MJF, you know, took the brass knucks from Regal and cheated. And so I do hope they address that, because these are some of my favorite characters on the show. And I would hate to see them get muddied in the wrong way, if that makes sense.
I think that's a great point. And having wrestlers be consistent with how you've come to know them is so essential to whatever the next chapter is for them. You want to have that transition point where you go, all right, they're not just randomly something different, that there's, you know, we saw that in WWE with Charlotte, you know, like among others, but other examples over the years where it's just like, okay, now she's not someone you're supposed to cheer, but there was no explanation for why she had shifted to a point where either we're supposed to cheer her or not cheer her. And yeah, you know, that's not great booking. So again, I want to give them a little bit of time to get there, but the clock is ticking. I'm with you, David.
Thank you. Absolutely. A couple of other questions. Do you think that Valkyrie should be Cargill? She is believable in size, and her strength comes across in the ring. As far as thinking, she's very brutish and strong in the ring when she wrestles. But they've also had Cargill beat so many people, and it almost feels unbelievable that anyone on Earth who isn't Superwoman herself could possibly beat her, if she isn't Superwoman. And I wonder, you know, Valkyrie's good, but so was Athena. That was actually my original pick to beat her. So would you pull the trigger on her, and if not, who?
So my thinking on this is, if they don't have someone else in mind and they don't have a great angle or a future match that they're targeting, then Valkyrie seems like a really good option. If they're thinking in their mind, we want to build to, say, All Out, Jamie Hayter against Jade Cargill. And we're going to have Hayter, you know, really build it up as essentially a co-main event on a pay-per-view, a dream match, maybe a unification match. Then I don't think you change it for Ty Valkyrie, who just hasn't established herself well enough in AEW. But if you think the way to establish her and elevate her and strengthen the women's division, and she's worth it to do it with, then beating Jade Cargill would help make her instantly. You know, I mean, that would more so than Action Andretti beating Jericho, because it wouldn't be seen as like a fluke. It would be seen as this new arrival is the real deal. Jake, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a bit hard to predict, but based on the story that they told on tonight's show, where, you know, the initial volley from Jade's camp is that she's banning Taya from using the, you know, the Rise of the Valkyries finisher because it's also, you know, called Jaded, and she had it copyrighted or something for use in AEW. And so it's kind of following a similar trajectory to the way that other Jade stories have been crafted. There's really no, at least evidence thus far, that Jade feels that Taya is a real threat to her. And until we see that take place, you know, where you know, Jade is on the back foot and she feels genuinely threatened, and there's an opportunity to explore some other aspect of her character, I'm just under the impression that they brought in Taya to lose to Jade to put her in position to perhaps challenge Jamie Hayter. At least that's my initial impression of it. Although I could be convinced that you know, that Taya is the right person. It just doesn't really feel like the company has a real justification to have two women's titles other than they have Jade and they don't want her to, you know, to be just another act in the background, and they almost created it for her. And I think she's kind of in a similar position to where Cody Rhodes was in AEW, where she lives on her own island that people yeah. occasionally interact with. And I think getting her out of that situation is probably the best step and best way to move forward.
Yeah. Yeah. David, any follow-up on that?
I actually really like the idea of having a build up to it. But I think one of you suggested having a build up to her facing Hayter at All Out and unifying the title. That sounds like yeah. a great idea, actually. Doing that, it would make sense because it feels just so hard, like you said, about her being in her own universe, that someone's going to come in and pierce that bubble and break it when everyone hasn't just like tried and failed, but failed almost hilariously. So, and it gets to a point where you build a skyscraper so high that it's just going to tumble over, and that's what it sort of feels like with her. And I think that Jade Cargill, when they first started having her do these short matches that were, you know, basically her, she meets a jobber, she destroys the jobber, and she doesn't have to worry about being a great in-ring technician, was good when she first started, because she was nervous on the mic when she first started. She didn't, you know, she had a look, but didn't quite look right with the straight white hair. And but she now has blossomed into like a new version of China, and she's great and good, and the title belt's nice, but I could see them taking it off of her and it not really hurting her as a character. And so now I feel like it's the time they just start looking around and coming up with an idea. I love your idea about doing it All Out like that. So
well, thank you.
They
I'll take credit.
yeah, there you go. There you go. If Tony Khan's listening to you, he should take your idea. Another thing, you mentioned Hook earlier, and I had written down some of my questions. One of the questions I had about Hook is, you know, like it had to, speaking of all these wins and the skyscraper getting tall, and I've been an advocate for Hook when I've called in on a couple of occasions, and then I used to write dark reports, elevation reports, and I was an advocate then that they should do something great with him. To have him winning, and he should have won tonight. That was exactly what you expected to be. He's got the manager's going to bounce the basketball. It's going to be funny. But, what do you think the end game is in 2 years' time from now? Do you think that Hook is going to be in the world title scene? And which I think he should be, but if you don't see him doing that, then are they using him correctly at this point?
Yeah. I mean, he was red hot for a while, and he's cooled off considerably. And it's kind of, I mean, I'm not sure if they can just keep doing what they're doing and expect to not have him cool off more. This feels very mid-card with Stokely. My concern is that they're concerned about his ring work, and they have to be very careful in crafting his matches, because it could turn out he's just not unnatural in the way that they want him to be, in terms of just being part of the flow of a match, in terms of taking bumps and telling the story and all that. There's still something really intriguing about him and his, obviously, with his demeanor and his look and his pedigree. But I just don't know what's holding them back from integrating him more in the mix. And we've talked about this before, David, where he's in a tough spot, because if you put him out there and have him work longer house show matches and it doesn't go well, as we saw this weekend with a certain women's match that went viral and it was awful, you can expose him in a way that's not good. So he's got to get better basically off camera. I guess I should ask around. I don't know how much he is working hard off camera to get better and what the opinion on him is, but he feels kind of like Jade. It's a good follow-up to the Jade discussion, so protected and so just in a very narrow lane of what they want to do with him, because they think that's how he'll stand out. But I worry that not only is it they're doing it because that's how he'll stand out, but because he hasn't shown that he can do more than that. We had the brief Hook and Jungle Boy thing. Jake, where are you on Hook in terms of, is he 2 years away from being a world title contender if they do everything right? Is he showing signs of that? And what do you think of where he is right now?
I think he's, as you mentioned, cooled off considerably. I don't know if there's a good place to integrate him into the card as a singles act, particularly if they aren't sure if he can go in and participate in long form matches where he's required to sell and where there's a certain level of thinking on your feet required. You know, if he's not ready for that level of regular competition on television, then maybe put him in a tag team. I guess there's got to be some other avenue for him to get more experience than just continuing to have him work very short dark matches and feel like he's spinning his wheels and losing what was a very bright perception of him at one point. And so I think there's they had some success with him and Jack Perry. I that's probably not ultimately what you would want to go with as a pairing, because I think they have higher aspirations for Perry currently than that. But there has to be someone that they could pair him with that would that would make a natural fit in that tag division. Because I think if they can carefully plan around how they use him and he could be there for that hot tag, it could be a lot of fun, particularly for the live audiences.
David, any follow-up on that or anything else for us?
I mean, I'm still on the side that if they can find a way to work around his shortcomings, whatever they may be, that he has the charisma to be a megastar. And if he can't talk, his dad is literally there that could talk for him and could definitely sell him as someone who could, choke you out, as he's shown over and over again with his opponents. I think that I think I'm very influenced by that, because I was at the last show they did in Greensboro, the only show they did in Greensboro, the Greensboro Coliseum show, the Christmas show in 2021, I think it was. And he was like you guys said, he was red hot. And the chanting, it was so loud. You think Stone Cold Steve Austin was coming out. I was taken aback, and I already thought Hook was kind of cool. But after that show, I was like, you have a T-shirt? I need to buy the T-shirt. Like, everyone is just great. They were chanting Red Rum. They weren't just chanting for him. They were coming up with chants for him, and he was not even in the ring or involved in the programming. They were just chanting for him randomly during commercials. And that's magic. And you can't buy that or manufacture that. You can capture that in a moment. And I feel like they let that slip through their hands, and it's such a huge loss for them. And I really wish they could find a way to capture that again, because you're right, he has cooled off significantly. And it's a shame. It's a damn shame, because you're not going to get that opportunity often. And it's happened not just with him, but with others. With Wardlow, I have a question about Top Flight in a minute, and Dante Martin is an example of that, although in a different way. And I think that what they should do is try to make a plan. Say, okay, it's not 2 years from now. That's fine. Say at least 26. Say 3 or 4 years. But we have an end game. We think that Hook should be at this spot, this point in time, on the timeline, and here's how we're going to get him there. Because right now, it just feels like he's wandering in the desert for 40 years, and they're hoping he'll find an oasis at some point. And that seems like a really bad a plot. When you're writing writing a novel that way, they call it pantsing, meaning by the seat of your pants. It feels like they're pantsing Hook. Just going by the seat of your pants and just seeing where it lands. And that's just not a good thing for somebody who had that kind of magic. I mean, imagine if they had Goldberg, and it was chanting Goldberg, and they're pushing Goldberg, had this huge thing, and all of a sudden they decided to completely, they did that. But imagine if they hadn't, they could have built so much more. And that's my closing thought on that. That's what I would do if I had a pin with Hook, because I would make a game plan. I mean, obviously, he's not ready to be world champion now. Or if they don't think world champion, TNT champion, whatever they think he should be. But then find a calendar, put the pin down and say, we're going this direction. And if they find out at some point he can't keep up, then at that point, cut your losses and have him lose and, stop investing. But I don't think that's the case. I think they can get to that point. That would be my option. Speaking of Dante Martin, one of my other things I'm just going to bring up is, I don't know if you guys, I'm sure you watched Rampage, but Rampage this past week, they did a skit with Top Flight and the Guns to set up the storyline for why they were going to be facing each other for the tag titles. It wasn't a great skit. It was borderline racist, but they, but it was still something I feel like they should have mentioned on Dynamite, because about half the people that watch Dynamite watch Rampage. That's, you know, maybe not even that many. And I feel like it would have given that match a lot more heat, and it would have made more sense of, like, ah, that's why this team is wrestling them, even though we haven't seen them really in that way in a while. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, Jake, the build for this tag match was just telling people it's happening and then presenting it. Did this, I mean, they only went 5 minutes, and it seemed like it was more there as an angle for Matt Taven and Mike Bennett to set up a feud with Top Flight. But if you're going to do something on Rampage to set up a match, should there almost always be a recap of that on Dynamite? And or perhaps they just thought, well, that wasn't very good, let's not include it, but then maybe do something else. Or was this fine? Because it, weirdly, the, you know, AEW Tag Team Champs were in a segment that felt like one of the two or three least important things on the show once it was all done.
Yeah, I mean, I watched the segment on Rampage. I may not have included it on this show if I had the choice. It was pretty rough, but they could have done something more from the the presentation perspective. Whether it's having Excalibur explain that there was a challenge issued on Rampage or whatever the case may be, give the audience the justification, even if you don't want to air something that didn't go as well as you had hoped. But I think that's a pretty common issue, when watching Dynamite. If you're not a regular Rampage viewer or you missed an episode, there are matches that get made or announced that don't get the proper recap, and they just feel like they're happening out of thin air, and it's unfortunate, because of the way that the show is paced and the density of the content most weeks, they just don't spend the time or energy to frame these matches with context, and I think it does harm them in a lot of ways.
All right, very good. David, anything else you want to bring up?
The last thing I wanted to bring up is just, and this is my last comment, was on FTR, which I'm so glad to see them back. FTR, they're awesome. But first off, I wanted to ask you guys before I left the conversation if you think they have signed, if they would do the storyline, if they've signed, if they had the match, do you think they should have the match at Double or Nothing? I hope they don't. I hope they wait that long and don't just hotshot it. Or and lastly, why you think they would up the ante so quickly? Like it really felt like they walked out, they confronted the Guns, and the Guns were like, we don't want to give you a match, and like, but you like us to retire? It just felt like they just volunteer that out of the blue. Just like, that's such a... I hope that's not how they negotiate their contracts. And but, have they officially gotten rid of the ranking system? Is there a reason for this in that sense? And those are my final questions regarding FTR. I thank you guys so much for having me as well.
Great. Thanks, David. Great topics. And you kind of hit the checklist of things I still wanted to hit on the show today. So that worked out really well. We didn't really backtrack at all either. So FTR, Jake, this episode, this angle seemed to indicate either way that they're going to win the tag titles and Tony's going to build a division around them, or they're going to lose to the Guns and it's their job on the way out of the territory, so to speak. What do you think of that? What do you think of what David asked? And what do you think of their the presentation tonight on the show?
They clearly didn't, shy away from encouraging the speculation, right? I think the crowd reaction, which, various states of shock about how quickly the segment progressed from, we want a rematch to we're going to put our careers on the line. There was a lot of sort of, when they panned to the crowd, you could just see a lot of people like, some of those rumors and insinuations may have been true about them coming up on the end of a deal and this potentially being, a legitimate you know, loser leaves AEW type situation. But, you know, if you had re-signed and you knew that you had built up that level of anticipation with some of the fan base, then you'd obviously use that to your advantage too. And so I think it's smart, but just based on the level of enthusiasm on the faces of FTR during this segment, they didn't look like they were thrilled to be out there. And either that's a piece of masterful acting, or they are, you know, on their last run here in AEW.
I wish that FTR in this promo explained why they were willing to go that far, because, you know, I know they don't have a ranking system anymore. They've just dropped that. And I'm fine with that, because as predicted before AEW launched, it's very hard to do rankings and book in pro wrestling. You know, pretty much all bookers drop it after a little while because it sounds like good in concept, and then it just becomes a headache. And people make fun of it, and it just, you know, it either ties your hands or you go against it in so many booking decisions. So, but they're going to get a tag title shot if they just win some matches. I mean, it's not like they're doing an angle where Tony Khan's out to get them on TV. So why should they shouldn't need to ante up their AEW careers to get a title shot? Top Flight just got a title shot, like, for nothing. So it just, that aspect didn't make sense. So to me, like, having some better explanation for why FTR would offer their AEW careers in order to get a title shot would have made more sense. I don't think
they had enough time. I think they were rushing to get through the segment, you know, to get on to the next thing. And maybe we'll get a follow-up promo where they add more context around that, and you know, FTR could show a little bit more fire about why they'd be willing to, you know, to put their careers on the line to get another shot at the guns. But I think it was, you know, maybe an attempt to capture some buzz, you know, based on, you know, sort of this open secret about FTR's contractual status, and see, you know, how the crowd responded to it. And I think the shocked faces, maybe that's what they were going for. Maybe it wasn't, but I think they got a reaction, and now they have to capitalize on it, and hopefully they can. You know, it's one of those things where you can believe that, yeah, I guess they could be wrapping up, or, you know, maybe they signed and this was an opportunity to, you know, to put them in a position to get a, you know, get a title win, and hopefully, you know, if they do win it, they can relaunch that tag division into something a bit more successful than it's been for the past few months.
Yeah. Yeah, even if it was just Dax or Cash saying, you know, we're so confident we can beat you, we will offer up our – I don't know. Again, I guess I'm checking myself, as I say, because I don't know if – especially if FTR are leaving and you think the Guns are an interesting act, I don't know if you want FTR just saying the Guns are such a joke of a championship team that they are – and they're so sure they're going to win that they're willing to put their AEW careers on the line. I mean, in a way, they're sort of – to make it make sense, they would almost have to demean the Guns too much. So, yeah, I mean, it feels a bit rushed. All right, going into tonight's show, in response to last week's show, Julian from London wrote, and I wanted to save this kind of for the end here as a little discussion point, because it's interesting the boxes they checked this week in how they followed up on some things last week with the Four Pillars match. But anyway, I'll read Julian's email here. He goes, I was listening with interest to your discussion about the lack of main event challengers for MJF. Wardlow, Ricky Starks, Aleister Black, Darby, Eddie Kingston, Rush, Takeshita, Bandido, and more are highly touted talents who seem a long way from a world title shot, lost in mid-card purgatory in AEW. I completely agree that none of these people are ready or being groomed for a top spot, but could they be? I don't think the issue is talent. It's booking. I keep thinking AEW needs to be a bit more WWE. Pick a guy, have him win every single match clean for a few months, and then you have your challenger. AEW is killing momentum with their insistence on long 50-50 matches and having people like Wardlow and Starks losing matches they should be winning. If one of those wrestlers were getting the Orange Cassidy undefeated streak in prime position to Dynamite, they'd be ready for MJF. Challengers for AEW titles tend to come out of the blue, rather than it feeling like two top guys on a collision course. We keep talking about AEW as if someone is magically going to become a main eventer, usually someone returning or a new signing. But isn't it simply that these mid-carders are not being booked properly? Too little is being done to choose who the top guys are, and too little effort is being made to present the chosen few as a big deal. More of a rant than a question, I'm afraid, but I'd love to hear your thoughts if the subject hasn't already been done to death. Thanks, Julian. Yeah, and it's interesting because David kind of brought up, you know, pick a time on a calendar and book backwards, choose Hook, and get and put them on a course where if things go well, you have laid the groundwork for fans to have been on a journey with him, and when he gets a title shot, it'll make sense. The Four Pillars segment last week, I think, was jarring to some people because they're like, wait, we're pivoting to those three as the choice for MJF in this title shot to get the next title shot against MJF, when it didn't seem like there was planning in the last weeks or better put months to set them up for this moment. And, you know, Wardlow's doing his thing, and Ricky Starks already, you know, did the MJF thing, and now he's in the Juice Robinson feud, for better or for worse. Aleister Black's in the Trios division. Darby's a top utility guy, and they do have him kind of in that spot. Eddie Kingston is Eddie Kingston, for better or for worse. There's some things there. Takeshita, they've got doing something different. I mean, there's talent in terms of they can work in the ring. But the stories that are being told with all of them are different than a story that leads to them being the obvious next person to get a title shot. Now, maybe Tony's looking at the calendar going, I'm going to do a pillar feud, and then I'm going to do Adam Cole, and then I'm going to do Kenny Omega, and I got my next year worked out for MJF. And he doesn't really need to worry about anybody else. And we can then critique or analyze or evaluate whether he's done a good job with that. But you don't need to get everybody ready. But do you think Julian's onto something in terms of, it is a pattern with AEW. We even see it with the tag team division. It's one of the criticisms of doing a trios division is you take away the ability to then have a deep tag division with teams vying to become credible challengers. So, Jake, your thoughts on what Julian said and what I said so far about it.
Yeah, I think sometimes the propensity of Tony Khan to want to book high quality matches every week that go, you know, and sometimes, you know, upwards of six or seven of them on an episode of Dynamite where, and a lot of them are getting, you know, 10 minutes each. And you end up sort of short-term booking your way out of long-term success in the sense that there's so much of the show taken up by the action, and he likes to book a variety of people and cycle them in and out of the show, that it's difficult for anyone to really gather the kind of momentum that you were just talking about. And I think consistency is the biggest issue. And I thought tonight was encouraging in the sense that, you know, we did have a story that opened the show that was touched on, you know, multiple times. They went back to it. So you have some of your stars featured in multiple segments, and then you pay it off in the main event. You know, those are good things. And perhaps you need to do some of that with your talent that you intend to, you know, to move into, you know, the main event picture eventually. It would be helpful if more people were talking about their long-term goals. But there's just not really enough promo time to go around for everyone to make those kinds of mission statement type promos. And until they modify the way that the show is booked week to week, in the sense that there's always going to be 60 plus minutes of in-ring action on every episode of Dynamite. That's almost guaranteed. And when you factor in that there's probably 20 to 30 minutes of commercials, that leaves, you know, a precious few minutes for transitions, for video packages, for promos, for things along those lines. And so the type of stuff that we're talking about when it comes to fixing some of the presentation issues that lead to long-term booking deficits where it doesn't feel like anybody is ready to make that jump to the next level, I think it requires a change in philosophy that it doesn't seem like Tony Khan has registered as being necessary. And I think that's really the long-term issue with the booking is the priorities of the booker in the near term oftentimes get in the way of the long-term benefits that could be had by establishing more characters and spending more time on promos and things of that nature.
We didn't talk about Sting. He opened up the show with Orange Cassidy and Darby in the six-man tag. I had made the case or brought up that I thought when Sting wrestles, it should be treated as a bigger deal than AEW, just throwing him on a poster and going, he's wrestling next week and not really doing anything to set it up. I stand by that. I think they made up some ground by when Sting came out. The announcers paid lip service to what an icon, what a legend, what a big deal he is. But I still think it defines down Sting to put him in an opening six-man tag against Kip Sabian, Butcher, and the Blade, with no backstory other than something they did at a house show that they have to catch us up on. Where are you on that? Do you agree with me that if you're going to have Sting hanging around, don't define him down by acting like, yeah, he's just hanging out here and every once in a while we have him wrestle or do a promo. Like, build up and try to get something more out of it.
Yeah, I think you should, you know, treat your legends with a bit more gravitas than they often afford Sting. And so I'm not a huge fan of him showing up for seemingly no reason. You know, I think, you know, he is a big enough star, particularly with the AEW audience, the ones who have stuck around with the promotion, who have are more than likely mostly hardcore wrestling fans who've followed Sting's career for quite a while, or at least have some you know, greater than normal awareness of it. You know, he should be treated like when he shows up, it's a big deal, and it should be an occasion. And you know, he can use that that star power to, you know, to impact the people that he's sharing segments with. And I don't think they do a good enough job of making that happen. You know, I really enjoy Sting. I think his ring work is, you know, is exceptional for somebody of his age and who has, you know, as many miles on him as he does. You know, to be able to go out there and put, you know, put himself into matches where he doesn't seem like he's out of place or that he's making, you know, he's making the people around him look worse. He contributes even up to, you know, I guess he's what, in his mid 60s now, you know, so it's incredible to watch him work. But I do think they could spend a lot more time, you know, putting together, you know, Sting in a way that makes him feel like a bigger impact when he shows up. You know, other than Tony Schiavone yelling Sting and making a big deal out of it, it doesn't right. really seem like he's, you know, he has that level of, you know, gravitas that I think is afforded by somebody who's had, you know, a Hall of Fame career multiple times over.
It is crazy. He's 64 years old and is able to do what he does and is still active out there, and using him in a six-man tag is the right situation if you're going to have him wrestling. And I hope they are thoroughly checking his health. You know, we don't want a Ricky Steamboat type situation where the last memory, you know, of him in the ring is, oh, that was, you know, one match too many and all of that. But even that underlines my point even more. If you're going to use him, and if he's, you know, truly, truly medically cleared to do something, treat it like a big deal. Treat it like a bigger deal than they do. All right. I think the last thing I want to bring up here, this is a more broad question about what happened last weekend. I'm going to get your take on it. We talked about Saray and Ruby Soho in their promo. Sammy Guevara and, well, especially Sammy, incorporated some meta stuff into that promo last week. And Jay from New York emailed and said, you've spoken about the importance of narrative consistency in pro wrestling, Wade, and I agree 100% with that. From the moment the red light goes on, everything on the show should be presented as real. It's kind of a contrast, by the way, as an aside to what Zach had said, you know, meaning, oh, get over it. It's already, you know, everybody knows it's fake, so we might as well not pretend it's not. That kind of approach in an email last week. So Jay goes, I 100% agree with you, Wade. From the moment the red light goes on, everything on the show should be presented as real. No promos, matches, or moves in those matches should damage the immersion. Unfortunately, I think that viewpoint is in the extreme minority now. I'm not sure if I agree with that. Maybe. We'll see. Like it or not, and I know you don't like it, Triple H was right when he called this the reality era. Pro wrestling isn't a movie. It's a magic show. The magicians expose the inner workings of their business so thoroughly, so completely, that the audience is no longer capable of suspending disbelief. The exposure has permanently changed how the wrestling industry is treated from without and within. AEW is very comfortable with insider references on their shows. From what I read online, many of their fans view suspending disbelief as almost beneath them. It's what John Cena was going for in his promo exchange with Theory, generating buzz online by shooting. Did he talk about winning the U.S. title? Did he mention the title? I don't remember at all. All I remember is Cena talking about piped-in crowd noise. The Bloodline story is an exception to my point. I get that. It's weird to think of that story existing in the same business as the Four Pillars promo on Dynamite, or wrestlers talking about booking and star ratings. I detest the meta stuff, too. Unfortunately, things aren't going backwards. I wish it would. Thanks and take care. So my major thought from that I have for Jay is it's not too late, because you can literally start next week with a policy where you make sure that the universe you create is, and Mike McMahon and Eric Sorchak were talking about this on their show earlier this week on the PW Torch Daily Cast. All that matters is that you can start now and say, we're not going to break character. We're not going to talk about stuff on Twitter that isn't helping forward the storylines. We're going to treat this like HBO treats Succession, which is these are actors and people know it. But just because people know they're actors and these aren't the real people, that doesn't mean we're insulting their intelligence by, from opening to closing credits, staying in character and staying within this universe that we create. So is damage done? Yes. Have they pulled on the thread on the sweater a lot and it's unraveled? Yes. But is it better to revert, so to speak, re-evolve into what this business at its core, I think, will be most successful being, which is this immersive, fictional simulated sport that consistently stays in that mode. And I truly, genuinely believe that there is so much more to be gained by taking the approach that all scripted dramas do, almost all. I mean, there's probably some of you go, what about that? What about when the dad on Modern Family looks at the camera? It's like, well, that's a pseudo documentary. That's built into the narrative. But I truly believe that there's more to be gained from that than whatever they're going for when John Cena talks about piped in crowd noise and you're not, you know, or the authority talked to Daniel Bryan about not being, you can't be the face of the company, as if that has anything to do with whether he wins or loses a match. And I think there's a sophisticated way to do it. You know, you can say, we don't want to give you a title shot because if you win, we're stuck with you on our posters. Like, you can tell that story, but it should be in the context of, we're not going to give you an opportunity because the match is real. And if you win that real match, which we have no control over, then we're screwed. And that you can bake that in and make it believable. And I think what, you know, the week that John Cena said what he said, and then you have a follow-up with what happened in the Four Pillars segment and Sammy Guevara's just awful instincts. I think it's a worthwhile topic to bring up. So I'm going to get your thoughts, Jake, on what you had to say and what I had to say.
Yeah, I'm of the preference of, you know, what's on screen should adhere to the rules of the fictional universe as closely as possible. I heard, you know, Steve Austin recently comment about, you know, that the stunner that he and Vince McMahon botched so badly at WrestleMania, and how, you know, he said, well, you know, that went so badly that there was no way for the audience to, you know, to suspend their disbelief. And so I just had to laugh to let them know that I was in on the joke. And I think there's going to be situations that occur on these shows when things don't go as planned, where you just kind of have to wink at the audience a little bit and go, yeah, sorry about that. You know, like it, and so I think some of those situations are unavoidable, but I don't think you should design programs or stories around a meta narrative that most of your audience probably doesn't comprehend. You know, like
those who do comprehend it, you're taking them out of a better experience by acknowledging, like, it's not a victory if people know what you're talking about. It's still a loss. Because you're taking people to know what you're talking about, and you're pulling them out of the world that you've tried to immerse them in.
No, exactly. And I think there's been efforts in the past to toe the line very closely between, you know, what is like a reality TV moment versus what is a scripted moment. And I don't think it's anything that wrestling has done effectively enough to justify its continued usage. You know, he brought up the Bloodline story and being sort of incredulous that it exists in the same business as what happened with with Sammy and to a lesser extent, Jack Perry, griping about Max not having to work enough dark tapings or whatever. You know, there's a certain amount of your fan base that, you know, ooze and ahs of that kind of stuff, but when you compare it to what I would consider sort of the artisan craftsmanship by comparison of what WWE and Paul Heyman and Roman Reigns and his and his crew, Sami Zayn and others, have been able to accomplish with the Bloodline story. And you point at that and you go, well, you see, it is possible. You know, like, if the performances are good enough and the writing is good enough, you can make wrestling feel like it's approaching the quality of you know, what people have come to term as prestige television. And is it at that level? Well, of course not. You know, it's not, I'm not going to be submitting, you know, Jey Uso and Roman Reigns for the Emmys or whatever, even though I think some people have given it that level of accolade. But
Some have treated it as more ridiculous than it sounds also on the other end. Like, I think there's some people like, it's terrible acting, and there's a vast middle ground where this can fall and still be really good.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not, you know, I've heard people liken it to community theater, and I think that's so, you know, insulting in a sense.
Right, that is my point, yeah. There was a pushback, there was a pushback that was more severe than called for.
Right, and so I think, you know, wrestling can be better, and I think as a philosophy, you know, if you're a critic or a follower or a fan of the medium, then you should be rooting for continuous improvement of these shows. And I think it's when you see, you know, those types of programs from Sammy Guevara, you know, like last week that it was widely panned, to me it's like, do they not have better ideas for him? Like, is he not being presented with, you know, a character that's better than that? Like, because I think the issue for me is, like, people often compare, you know, WWE's format as being overly scripted to AEW's programming as being under scripted. And maybe there's a medium there. And I think Big Swole in particular, when she left AEW and she talked about her release on her podcast, we talked at length about the fact that there are a lot of people who don't thrive in that environment where they're speaking off the cuff and they don't have a script and they're working without a net. And there may be a need to have a mixture of scripted and maybe unscripted content based on, you know, who's involved in these stories and programs. And so my gut feeling is that AEW over time, if Tony Khan is really looking to improve the narrative structure of the show, you know, may end up adopting different standards as the years go by. But I think the meta narrative and, you know, the over-reliance on the work shoot style of promo, you know, we've seen a lot of those from MJF. We've seen a lot of them from Sammy Guevara. You know, we see it brought up in other programs. It feels like more of a crutch and a weakness to me than it feels like an asset to the company, and I hope it changes long-term.
Yeah, yeah. I talked about the scripted promo in the Wade Keller Hotline today for VIP members in the Ask Editor format. Somebody asked about whether last week's four pillar segments, among other examples, is a sign that maybe AEW, you know, there's a middle ground between WWE's overscripting over the years and where they are now. And so I had a lot to say about that. I'll close with, because it applies to a lot of what we're just saying here, Julian from London emailed about the four pillar segment last week. And he said, the four pillar segment this week was so typically AEW. It was a great idea and with a proper groundwork would have been an amazing defining segment. As usual, though, AEW threw it out there without the booking prep it deserved, and so it flopped. Instead of feeling like an awesome showdown between AEW's top stars, I was left feeling that they'd badly dropped the ball on these guys. What were these underpushed mid-carders doing with the world champ? Sammy has only had two singles matches this year, Sammy Guevara, both on Rampage. Darby hasn't been on TV in a month and a half. They're ice cold and feel grossly out of place in the world title picture. Jungle Boy is the only guy with any momentum behind him, but has never main evented anything, and he feels mid-card. If you're going to do this angle, why not spend months building up these guys, have them main event and winning on Dynamite, having them cutting promos, portray them as a big deal if you want us to buy them as a big deal. This was so typical of AEW short-sighted, lazy ADHD booking. Until Tony's actually willing to put some time and work into building people, AEW will remain a star-free zone. It's so frustrating to see good ideas ruined with lazy, haphazard booking. So, yeah, I mean, it's harsh, Jake, but I totally see where Julian's coming from. I think there are times where AEW does look sometimes like a rushed first draft of a term paper that was done on an overnight cram session, as opposed to the amount of paying this industry and the wrestlers involved and the craft, the respect of putting more time and getting more people involved in looking over what they're doing and fleshing out what's working and eliminating what's not. And it sometimes AEW feels like a rushed first draft of what potentially it could be. And I understand the frustration. And for some people, as long as you have 630 splashes and dives, it's all as good. And AEW's found out how big that audience is. But there is, as you said, pro wrestling can be better. And that four pillar segment and the way Julian, critiqued it is an example of where I think AEW putting more time and effort into the craftsmanship of this would pay off.
Yeah, I really don't have a disagreement with what Julian had to say there, other than, you know, I give, you know, Tony Khan the benefit of the doubt in that I don't think he goes into this with the intent of it being presented as a rushed, you know, first draft of a much better product. I think it's maybe there's so many talents that are vying for his time and attention, and part of that is his own doing, in the sense that he's oversubscribed to talent over the last couple of years in a way. But I think, you know, there's certainly flashes of brilliance at various points in AEW's history where it's like, oh, you know, I wish there were more segments, there were more character moments like this on these shows. But there's also like these dumbfounded looks on your face when you have these lows, and it's like a roller coaster watching some of these episodes week after week, where it's like, can they follow up on last week's great episode with another one? And then it's just like this left turn that you weren't expecting. And so I think the biggest issue that Tony Khan is fighting at this point is narrative consistency. And maybe that could be found by, you know, trimming the number of people that are appearing on TV every week and really focusing on a narrower group of people. Maybe that will be found by expanding his creative staff to include, you know, some writers and some more creative people. I don't know that there's a silver bullet answer to this question, but I think AEW's biggest problem is characters and stories, and it'll remain that way until philosophically there's some sort of sea change internally.
Yep. All right, very good. Jake, anything else from the show or your notes or straight thoughts you want to bring up before we sign off here?
I think we covered everything, Wade. I'm
yeah.
good.
Good, cool. Tell people more about what you do for ProWrestling.net and how they can transition from this podcast to hear more from you.
Yeah, you can find my weekly television reports. This week it was Dynamite. Sometimes I end up getting shifted over to SmackDown on Fridays. I also do the weekly ProWrestling.net weekly podcast with Jason Powell. It's the flagship podcast for members. And I also join Jason for all pay-per-view audio reviews for WWE and AEW. So you can find out more information on membership over at pwmembership.net.
Awesome. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thanks to our callers and emailers, all as always. And if you're interested in being an on-site correspondent on a future show, be sure to drop me a line at WadeKellerPodcast@pwtorch.com. Jake, great talking with you. Glad we had a chance to dive into some of those big-picture emails, too, on the show tonight. We'll talk to you soon.
Always a pleasure, Wade. Thanks for having me.